Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And on this episode, we're going to be talking about the Halloween reboot directed by David Gordon Green. This reboot's been in the works for a fairly long time, if memory serves, right?
I have no idea, actually.
I feel like, if not necessarily this reboot, as it ended up being, the idea of launching a new Halloween has been kicking around pretty much ever since Rob Zombie stopped at two movies, I think.
Yeah, I've still haven't seen the Rob Zombie Halloweens. I mean, it makes sense to do it in 2018, you know, 40-year anniversary. The last time they did something like this was in 1998, which was 20 years after the original.
And also 20 years ago, which, who boy.
Yes.
Jesus.
Who boy Jesus. You heard it here, folks.
Anyway, when I first heard that David Gordon Green and Danny McBride were writing a script for a new Halloween film, mm-hmm. I was sort of intrigued, but also kind of skeptical. I didn't really know what to make of that.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen, actually, Pineapple Express or Your Highness or a lot of their collabs. But, you know, David Gordon Green is a on-again-off-again good director. I like George Washington. I like Prince Avalanche well enough.
Yeah, I have seen Pineapple Express and Your Highness, and while I enjoyed the former, the latter is pretty weak.
So I hear.
But anyhow, so it was kind of a counterintuitive pair to hand off this franchise to, but, well, we'll just get into the synopsis and then we'll tell you what we thought.
Fire away.
So, the film begins with a couple of reporters coming to Smith's Grove, the asylum where Michael has been kept on again, off again for 55 years, I guess, including the 15 years prior to the events of the first film.
Oh, right, yes.
And we find out later that they're podcasters. And, you know,
a little less glamorous.
Yeah, we both got a kick out of that for, I think, obvious reasons. But anyway, they come to interview Michael, and inevitably, of course, Michael has a new doctor that they have to deal with, because R.I.P. Donald Pleasance. I'll get more into that later. But they meet the doctor, who gives them the lowdown, like, you know, he doesn't talk, and, you know, don't get too close, etc., etc. But they go out into the courtyard, where a bunch of inmates, including Michael, are, you know, chained to posts, and then they have, you know, sort of squared off areas in which people are not allowed to step, so they don't get hurt. Anyway, they try and get a reaction out of Michael. They want to get him to say something. Not much is really happening. The male podcaster pulls out the mask, the bleached Shatner mask, and sort of holds it up to Michael and, like, keeps calling on him to say something, tell them something. And while all the other inmates are kind of going apeshit at this point, making all matter of, like, weird screechy animal noises or what have you, saying gibberish, Michael, true to form, remains impassive, and for a final time, the podcaster shouts, "Say something!" And then it smash cuts into a Halloween title card. Anyway, obviously, they can't really keep up with that. So they go to interview Jamie Lee Curtis, Laurie Strode, for those of you who don't know, which should be no one. She's the protagonist of the original Halloween film. And at this point in her life, she is a recluse who has
sort of grown into a doomsday prepper.
A little bit. She's basically walled herself up in this impenetrable compound with lots of fences and, you know, security lights. And the house itself has a ridiculous quantity of locks on all the doors and the windows and so forth. They manage to coax their way inside by offering a $3,000 bribe to interview her, but they don't really get a lot out of her.
No.
Because they're very clearly like, we need to understand Michael's motivations, and she hews to the old Dr. Loomis line of he's pure evil, there's nothing to understand.
Mm-hmm.
So $3,000 not super well spent. They leave, and then the film sort of segues into us meeting Laurie's family. She has a daughter, custody of whom she lost when the daughter was about 12.
Yeah, this is all established during the botched interview with the podcasters.
Yeah.
So gets all that sort of info out there relatively efficiently, I thought.
Yeah. The daughter's name is Karen. She's played by Judy Greer. Always nice to see. And then Laurie also has a granddaughter named Allison. Allison has just been inducted into the National Honor Society, and this is a big deal, and there's going to be a ceremony, and she wants Lori to come and is asking her mother if she's contacted grandmother, which is, she, without exception, never calls her grandma, always grandmother. It's kind of weird. I don't know. It just stuck out to me.
Yeah, I think it speaks to the kind of alienation there. It's a little too stiff and formal.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that again. Anyway, there's a lot of family tension.
Estrangement, that's the word I was looking for, not yeah. Alienation. Speaks to their estrangement.
There's a lot of family tension, and, I mean, it's all relatively straightforward. We don't need to dwell on it. Allison goes to school. There's a bunch of pretty standard high schoolers hanging out, like, on the way to school yeah. and then at school
stuff. A little bit better than average, at least relative to what we've covered in yeah. our previous three episodes.
Yeah, certainly better than our experience, but really nothing to write home about.
Just perfectly functional teenage banter.
Right. And then we have a scene of this man and his son driving around through the woods. They come upon a crashed bus, which, wouldn't you know it, is the Smith's Grove bus that was supposed to be transferring Michael to his new
maximum security
hellhole.
The hellhole,
as the doctor characterizes it. And being an idiot, the father gets out of the truck. I'm gonna go see if anybody's hurt. And then, eventually, when he hasn't heard from his dad in a couple of minutes, the kid gets out. He takes a gun, which is smart, but doesn't really end up helping him. He gets super murdered. The cops show up way too late to do anything about it, of course. And then it's the next day, and we're back with the podcasters.
Yeah, they're at a gas station filling station kind of thing, which is clever because it's an excuse for Michael to get his hands on his old outfit. You know, the gray jumpsuit.
Right.
In addition to the mask, which they obviously, you know, have in their in possession still.
Yeah, in their trunk.
Having so waved it around in his face in the prologue to Little Effect.
Right. So
I say in his face. His back is to the camera for the whole scene, mercifully. You never get a really clear look at his exposed visage. Although, you see a lot more of it than I was expecting. But we can address that later on.
Sure.
Put a pin in it.
So the dude podcaster, Simon, I believe his name is. Simon is filling the tank. And Mallory, I think, is the woman's name. She goes to the bathroom.
The loo.
Yeah. Yeah, she goes inside and asks the clerk for the loo, and he's just like, what?
Just, everyone's heard that before. It's not like a very, I don't know.
Maybe not in Haddonfield.
Maybe.
Who knows? But anyway, she goes around back into this very disgusting bathroom, and only one stall is sufficiently clean to be usable, so she gets in there. Meanwhile, Michael comes in, starts pushing stall doors open. A little bit reminiscent of the bathroom scene in Hellfest.
Yeah, much better executed in this case, because one of our complaints about Hellfest is that when the would-be victim scrambles across the floor from one stall to the next, the stall that she arrives and is mysteriously locked from the inside as though its last occupant had just vanished into thin air or, like, you know, Houdini'd out of there somehow. In this case, she has to scramble to get it locked before Michael gives chase.
So Michael gets to her stall and tries to open it. She's like, ah, there's somebody in there.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem to realize the danger she's in immediately. He kind of takes a couple steps away, comes back, and then he drops a bunch of teeth over the stall door, yeah.
Which is in the trailer, I think, at least the one that I saw.
Yeah, I believe so. Which is more than a little alarming. Meanwhile, Simon is kind of looking around inside the filling station, and we see that the two employees on site have been straight murdered. The clerk has had his jaw, like, half ripped off, looks like.
Teeth freshly harvested.
Yeah, no teeth, so that's where they came from. And then there's another guy in, like, laying in a pool of blood in the garage in a wife beater and whitey tighties, so that's where the jumpsuit came from. Then Michael, is rattling the door on Mallory's stall again, and she starts screaming for help. Simon gets over there, tries to take a good whack at Michael with a crowbar, doesn't really do anything because he's Michael Myers. And then Michael grabs Simon and starts beating the ever-loving shit out of him. Just keeps smashing his head against the wall. There's a lot of blood, and Simon survives way longer than it makes any sense for him to, I think. Like, Michael gives him four or five real good smashes into the wall. I figure after the third one, your skull breaks.
Yeah, when you see the damage that's being done to the wall, it begs the question of, the damage being done to the flesh. And just to be clear, the reason I was harping on about the business with her slithering across the floor to the second stall earlier is because, and why I point out that it's better executed than it was in Hellfest is not just for the sake of harping on like a plot inconsistency in Hellfest. That's not really important to me. It's just that it's better to have her scrambling to try to get the second stall locked because having more sense, more sources of tension is better, and it just gives you a sense of, the character's resourcefulness. It's like the scene in the original Halloween when Jamie Lee Curtis is in the closet and she's rapidly trying to make a makeshift weapon out of a coat hanger. It makes you think like, yeah, that's what I would have done in that scenario. Good shit.
After Michael finishes smashing Simon on the wall, Simon is still not dead. Michael starts bashing his head against the stall door, the second one that Mallory's crawled into.
Yeah, it's eventually, a real brouhaha.
And throughout this scene, Simon doesn't die. He ends the scene having been tossed in the corner, still alive.
Yeah, dying.
And presumably dying off screen, because we never see him again.
Yes, no, he's toast. Yeah. Guaranteed.
Meanwhile, after Michael has bashed the stall door open, he picks Mallory up and just sort of crushes her windpipe. Very Michael Myers. So, yeah, after that, he reclaims the mask, and he's good to go. Meanwhile, it has come to Jamie Lee Curtis's attention that the bus has crashed, and so she's on high alert.
As if she wasn't before.
Right. Yeah. She's at
whatever the next level after high alert is.
Yeah, right.
She spent her whole life on high alert. It's kind of her defining characteristic.
She goes so far as to break into her daughter's house to demonstrate how unsecure it is. her daughter and her daughter's husband are obviously not thrilled with this.
They don't appreciate the lesson.
So they kind of shoo her out. But that night, which is Halloween, of course, Michael gets to town and he starts murdering folks.
Mm-hmm, yep, he's got the mask, he's got the jumpsuit, he's ready to go. He gets a knife from an old lady's kitchen in a scene that's very reminiscent of him getting the weapon in Halloween 2. Mm-hmm. And opens very similarly. There's, little allusions all over the place to, I think the bit in the bathroom stall is from H2O, actually.
Yeah, that sounds right.
So it's sort of a interesting patchwork. It's not just slavishly devoted to the very first movie in the franchise, which was nice to see.
And it's interesting too because, and we didn't touch on this at the beginning of the episode, but we probably should have. This film only takes the original as canon.
Yes.
It obliterates the rest of
them. It's a big old retcon.
And it handles this relatively deftly.
Yes.
I remember.
Even the marketing handled it well, because it's a complicated idea to put across, partly because this has been done before. Like, H2O in the 90s retconned all but the first two. So it's not even the first, like, hard reset that's been done. So you have to, in, a 2.5-minute trailer, explain how this is different than the last hard reset, which I think was all pretty well managed, and it's managed well in the film proper as well.
Allison is, during the scene where she's walking to school with her friends, they're talking about the situation and, with her grandmother. And her friend's stoner boyfriend is kind of like, yeah, wasn't he like her brother? And
Which is a Halloween 2 idea,
yeah,
for the record.
And Allison just says, nope, That was just
something people made up. Yeah, common misconception.
an urban legend that
Which
they.
I thought was clever because at least when I watched the trailer, it gave me this kind of funny notion that like the babysitter murders, as they called them in this movie, which I think is also clever because I think that was the working title of the screenplay before it was called Halloween. Or like that was what Deborah Hill and John Carpenter were supposed to, they were just commissioned to do a movie about babysitters getting murdered. So naturally that's your first draft, you know.
Course.
And you know, the rest came from then. But anyway, I digress. This idea that the plot of Halloween 2 is just an urban legend that sprung up around the events of the first movie kind of creates this like Russian nesting doll in my head of like a lot of people think that Halloween 2 actually happened and that Jamie Lee Curtis and not Jamie Lee Curtis, Laurie Strode and Michael Myers are brother and sister. And then probably fewer people think, I would imagine, that Halloween 4, 5, you know, 6 happened, and only like the craziest people are like the only the most tinfoil hat kind of like serial killer junkies think that Michael was part of some weird pagan cult or whatever Halloween 6 is about. I haven't seen it.
And then there's exactly one guy sitting in a basement somewhere writing furiously on the internet about how Michael was kickboxed to death by Busta Rhymes. So, yeah, it's there are layers to the mythology.
At least that's the implication. Like, that's what I took away from it, which I is kind of, you know, any like Halloween fanatic who's like getting hung up on the different timelines. That's how I square it in my head. And again, haven't seen a lot of Halloween movies, so I'm not what you'd call a fanatic. But even to me, I think that that nod to the series continuity that they're discarding, it's dismissive, but it's not disrespectful, I don't think.
I would agree with that. The fact that they did that, but also are simultaneously doing callbacks to various non-original
Yeah, it shows that
installments.
they've studied them all and
Right.
taken, you know, bits and pieces from all of them, which, you know, indicates kind of a degree of respect for your elders.
Right. So, as we said, it's Halloween. Michael's doing some straight murdering. I appreciate it when he gets the knife because there's a very achievement unlocked sort of
Well, yeah, it's the
sensation you get
last
from
piece
it.
of the puzzle. You
Yeah,
know, he's got the
exactly.
mask, he's got the jumpsuit, and now he's complete.
Yeah, like he beats the old lady to death with a hammer
And then drops it.
and then drops it and then picks up the knife from her counter. So that was kind of cool. Because it's Halloween, there is a school dance at the high school. That's where Allison is with her boyfriend and her boyfriend's friend, but not her friend from the earlier scene, the retcon scene. Said friend is off babysitting,
Natch.
waiting for stoner boyfriend Dave, and I'll explain in a minute why his name is memorable.
Oh, yeah.
Allison eventually leaves the dance because she sees her scumbucket boyfriend kind of making out with this other girl.
Yeah, and he's a little toasty. He's had one too many. He's been like sipping on a flask surreptitiously, and he steals her cell phone, which I thought was like a slightly contrived means of getting her cell phone out of the picture, which, you
Right.
know, is a perennial slasher movie problem this day and age.
Yeah.
Some movies handle it better than others. This one handled it well enough, but
But it was kind of weird.
well, yeah.
He just sort of like unprompted snatches her phone and then throws it into a bowl of sour cream, it looks
Like
like.
pudding, maybe?
Yeah, I couldn't really tell what that was supposed to be. I figured it was going to go in punch, and then there's another bowl to the right, and he throws it in that. Anyway, so she's leaving, and so she's walking the streets in danger, presumably. And meanwhile, boyfriend's dopey friend is kind of chasing after her. There's
Comic relief sidekick kind of character.
and there's the obligatory scene where he's like, "Well, you deserve better. You're great." And like loading her down with compliments, and she's like, "Oh, well, thank you." And like, "I know a shortcut." So he takes her to the shortcut and then makes a pass at her, and
she's not having it.
She's absolutely not having it.
And he gets all, like, you know, a little bit butthurt about it, and then, you know, it's like, oh, I'm just really drunk, you know. It's still, like, it's well played, and it's just an excuse to separate them more than anything, make them more vulnerable to attack.
They get separated, and the friend is just kind of, like, hanging out, sprawled drunkenly in this backyard.
Someone's lawn.
On someone's, in someone's backyard that has security lights. Which leads to
motion sensitive lights.
Yeah, motion lights, and this leads to what I think is probably the coolest murder sequence, where Michael is kind of like hiding behind a tree, not very well, as it turns out. The dude sees him, and then is just like,
so he's doing that typical Michael Myers thing where he's kind of hiding, but he's not really trying to hide. He wants you to notice him. He does a lot of that in the original, so it was nice to see that come back.
Yeah, and
less of him just like jumping out of the shadows like a ninja, more like you see him at the end of the block and then try to convince yourself that it's nothing,
right.
And then you turn around, he's a little bit closer. That to me is a lot scarier.
Yeah, no, absolutely. This dude is kind of pouring his guts out to Michael Myers, which is funny. Like,
yeah.
I just wanted to, like,
have you ever really, like, had, you know, had it bad for a girl and she just wasn't into you, you know, and you just couldn't have her? And luckily Michael remains completely impassive during all of this. I was afraid, especially given, like, the fact that Danny McBride had a hand in this, that there would be, like, a little bit more levity there. I was just relieved to see that Michael didn't respond at all.
Right.
He's just, you know, he's the shape. He's not human for all intents and purposes. Even if the dude is saying is touching him in some way, it wouldn't register, you know,
no.
Superficially.
Absolutely not. The security lights flick off, and then dude gets up, and they turn back on, and Michael has vanished.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, yeah, where'd you go, dude? Michael pops up behind him, but much closer.
Yep, they stand still and regard each other for a moment.
Lights go off, lights go back on, and he's closer. Dude starts running away from Michael, gets stuck on a gate, basically. He's trying to climb a fence.
His costume gets,
gets snagged, and he gets stabbed multiple times. And then Michael shoves his head onto one of the spikes of the gate.
Yeah, like you're mounting a pumpkin or
through
something.
Through the chin.
Well, Allison witnesses that, or comes back to see the carnage, and that's when she and Michael confront each other for the first time on opposite sides of this gate, upon which her friend has been pinned like a moth.
Yeah. During this stretch of the film, we've seen a lot of Allison's friend, whose name is Vicky. Okay, I was sick of not knowing her name. Vicky, who, as we said, is babysitting this kid named Julian, who is awesome.
He's very funny.
And they have this banter at one point. She talks briefly on the phone to stoner boyfriend Dave. That is his full name. I'm going to call him that every time. And says something about, like, doing some of that Alakazam or whatever. And then she tries to play it off like they're not talking about weed. And Julian is not having it.
Yeah, they have a good rapport, the two of them. He threatens to get her in trouble. She threatens to get him in trouble. And, you know, it's kind of like, it's both like two children having, like making fun of each other, and also like two adults having a negotiation, which I think is what makes it funny. Because, you know, she's in high school, but she's not, like, substantially older than him. That's the weird thing about, like, I don't know, babysitting.
Yeah.
And the bonds that form between kids and teenagers in that setting, they play that very well.
Yeah, no, that was definitely a highlight. Stoner boyfriend Dave shows up. Julian is sent to bed. Vicky and Dave are making out on the couch, as is obligatory. They hear a loud thunk from upstairs, and Vicky is very disturbed by this. Dave figures it's just Julian. I think he says taking a dump, which is...
It's a really cacophonous dump.
It's the loudest dump of all time. Eventually, she persuades him to get up and start walking upstairs. And Julian runs down the stairs as they're coming up. And Dave tries to call him out for making so much noise. And Julian's just like, shut up, Dave!
And classic Julian.
Then tells Vicky that Dave should go first.
Yeah.
And we tend to agree. But no, Vicky goes up. Meanwhile, Dave just kind of fucking wanders off. He like goes, smokes a joint or something.
Starts fucking around in the garage, yeah.
On a motorcycle. It's weird. Vicky goes upstairs, checks out the room, does a fake out to Julian where she like walks, you know, past the doorway to where she can't be seen and starts saying like, "Sir, you have to get out of here. Leave. Leave now. I'm going to call the police."
Yeah, and then she jumps out and
just like, gotcha.
Frightens her ward.
And then he's basically like, "Ah, fuck you." Goes back inside, gets in bed, and says to Vicky, "You know, hey, can you close my closet door?" She tries to, but is unsuccessful because there is a Michael Myers in the way.
Yes.
It's, you know, caught on his foot or something. And eventually, he shoves the door open.
Lurches out of the closet like a, you know, quintessential childhood boogeyman, which is fitting.
Yeah. And starts waving the knife at her. She gets cut, but it looks for a moment like she's going to get away. And then just banana peel slips on the floor. You know, that's what you get for wearing socks on hardwood, I guess.
Yeah, serves you right. Maybe.
And he gets straight up murdered. During this time, she's screaming. Eventually, Dave fucking hears, and he gets off his goddamn motorcycle to go investigate. Julian runs down the stairs and tells Dave to get the fuck upstairs and, you know, help his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And he cuts away at that point. Because later, after Lori and Deputy Hawkins show up to investigate the disturbance separately, they arrive separately. We see Dave having been, like, mounted to the wall, basically.
Yeah.
Dave doesn't even get his own death scene. Poor Dave.
Poor Dave.
Thus ends stoner boyfriend Dave.
Gone but not forgotten.
So, when Lori and Deputy Hawkins arrive, they spot Michael. They take a couple shots at him. Lori actually wings him.
Mm-hmm.
But, obviously, Michael gets away. Then they kind of team up, I guess, and they go grab Judy Greer and husband.
Because by this point, there's a straight-up manhunt in effect.
Yeah, because Michael has killed, like, six people.
Yeah, and which I appreciated that that happens at about the midway point, because you couldn't... At this point, Haddonfield knows the score. You know, it's not like Jaws 2 or one of those sequels where Laurie has to run around the entire movie trying to convince people she's not crazy. Thank God.
It looked briefly like that's what was going to happen you know, she tries.
But they don't drag it out.
Yeah, she tries mercifully. In vain for so long to convince Karen, her daughter, that, you know, bad shit's out there. But anyway, yeah, no, there's a manhunt. That's good. The Strode family minus Allison is packed off to Laurie's compound. Deputy Hawkins goes out looking for Allison and eventually finds her, you know, in the company of, I don't know who the hell those people are supposed to be, but a bunch of, you know, bystanders, basically.
Yeah, I think she just ends up pounding on some random door and is given admittance. And Hawkins shows up with Michael's doctor in tow.
Who has been mostly AWOL because he was on the bus with Michael.
Yeah, he was injured. He himself got winged.
He got more than winged. He got pretty well shot in the chest by the kid who got murdered.
Yes,
during that scene, who shot him by mistake. So the doc has spent most of the movie just recuperating in the hospital. But he's teamed up with Hawkins at this point. They retrieve Allison, and they are headed to the compound where everybody's gonna hunker down. But they're telling Allison, like, hey, keep an eye out for Michael.
As if she wasn't already.
Right.
As if she won't be for the rest of her life now.
And she spots him, and Deputy Hawkins gets ready to just run him down with the truck.
Mm-hmm.
And does so. He plows right into Michael, knocks him on his ass flat.
Credits roll. Just kidding.
Yeah, we wish.
How'd you go in there?
Yeah.
I'm sure I didn't.
No. Deputy Hawkins gets out, basically wants to make sure Michael is dead, gonna give him the double tap.
Yep, good man.
The doc gets out and goes over and
he's checking Michael's vitals.
Checks the pulse, pronounces Michael dead.
Seems very disappointed, borderline distraught.
And Deputy Hawkins still wants to blow his brains out.
Mm-hmm.
The doc's trying to get him not to do it, and Hawkins isn't having it. So at this point, the doc whips out this like fancy hidden knife.
He unsheathes his pen, yeah.
And stabs Hawkins in the throat.
Has a heel turn where it's revealed that he orchestrated, you know, Michael's whole escape.
Yeah.
Which makes more sense that it would happen on Halloween that way. I'm here for there being a puppet master to make it not seem like such a strange turn of events, such a, you know, improbable coincidence.
Yeah. At this point, the doc puts on the mask, which I thought was kind of a weird decision. I didn't really like that.
He doesn't keep it on for very long.
No.
It's like less than a minute.
It's like...
And he talks in it, which I think is supposed to make you uncomfortable. It seems so perverse. It's like a mime talking, you know? He gets one line of dialogue wearing the mask, and I feel like it's kind of supposed to feel sacrilegious, I think, which was kind of interesting, because it's like, I don't know. He obviously reveres Michael Myers, but on a fundamental level just kind of doesn't get it.
Yeah.
Which I think is the key to understanding his character, you know, what character there is.
Yeah, I don't know. I just don't think it really worked. I thought it was kind of goofy with him wearing the mask, but we can get into that later.
Yeah, I didn't love it or hate it.
He drags Michael into the backseat of the truck, throws him back there with Allison, and then they drive over to the compound. The doc gets out and, you know, lets Michael out, and Michael gets up and basically knocks the doc on his ass.
Michael busts out of, like, he, like, pushes the partition.
Oh, that's right.
Forward.
Thank you. Yeah, no, like, he
pins the doctor to the steering wheel.
Yeah.
Sartain, is that his
Sartain,
name?
Sartain, yeah. Anyway, he gets the doc out and throws him on the ground and straight up stomps on his his head and smashes it like a melon. Very, very visceral.
So Allison takes off running into the woods at this point.
And she spends a lot of time in the woods, which is weird because the doc stopped Hawkins' truck like a few hundred feet down the road from Laurie's compound, where there is another cop car parked.
Yeah, I think that it's just an editing issue. It seems, because we don't see her running through the woods for an interminable period. We just kind of leave her alone and then cut back to her. And it's like, oh, she's still in the woods, I guess. Maybe she got lost. You know, she's panicked. It's dark.
I mean, it's
not like
not...
she spent a lot of time on grandma's creepy, like, estate.
Right. No, it's not incomprehensible by any means. It is just kind of weird.
Yeah. I think it comes down to the editing.
Yeah. And then it's pretty much just into the end game of Michael is trying to murder everybody in the house, which at this point is Laurie, Karen, and Karen's husband. Predictably, Karen's husband dies first.
This is the most expendable of the three, yeah.
There's a sort of cat and mouse game that Michael and Laurie play inside the house, which, you know, obviously makes sense. Eventually, that ends with Michael throwing her over a balcony, where she kind of like tumbles to the ground and lands flat, and, you know, very callback to the first Halloween. Where,
ending of the first Halloween, yeah.
Where she does the same to him. And also, just like that, there's a cutaway and then a cutback, and she's no longer on the ground. Mm-hmm. She has vanished.
And there's like a little scare cord that accompanying it, which is funny because it's almost like more for Michael's benefit. Like, she's become the slasher all of a sudden.
Like, remember this, Michael?
Yeah, he should be worried. Yeah, which is, I mean, the last time they did this exact thing in 1998, there was a lot of that too. Like, her getting the drop on him and really giving him hell. But in H2O, it almost had more of like a WWF kind of vibe to it. Like, they were really just knocking each other around. I think this is a little bit more, I don't know, a little bit classier.
Yeah.
And it's I'm impressed that it's as tense as it is, because for most of it, Michael has literally brought a knife to a gunfight. She's like ready to, you know, just
she is hardcore armed.
Put a cap in his ass, as it were. And, you know, it's not his weapon of choice. So the fact that he's still an imposing presence, I think, speaks volumes. And it's not by making her look weak. Like, she's very resilient. So it's not like she's come a long way since the first one. Yeah. Needless to say, she's had 40 years to prepare for this showdown.
Prepare. And in fact, there's a lot of mention made of how part of the reason that Karen was taken out of her custody is the way that she raised her, constantly training her in combat and yeah. with guns.
Like a boot camp, basically.
Which ends up proving to be useful because at this point, even though Lori's clearly not dead, she's sort of scampered off somewhere. Karen and Allison are in the basement by themselves. Karen starts like crying out for Lori, like, "Mom, I can't do this." Turns out it's a fake out.
Mm-hmm.
Michael, you know, appears in the doorway. Karen literally says, "Gotcha," shoots his ass. There's some tussling, but eventually they trap Michael in the basement.
In the panic room, yeah.
The announcement is made that it's not a cage, it's a trap. And then, I don't know how to put it, but Michael murder protocol is engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And the house just starts burning itself down.
Yep.
With Michael trapped inside. And that's the end.
Yeah, it ends relatively abruptly.
Yeah.
Which I didn't love.
Yeah, and
it's a little bit, the way it's shot, you see him burning to death, but it's a little bit too cagey for my liking. Halloween 2 also burnt him into a pile of cinders, but it like lingered on the shot of his immolated corpse and like really, you know, definitively kind of put him in the dirt in a way that this movie doesn't.
Yeah, so I don't know.
It seems like they're trying to hedge their bets, which I'm not wild about. Blumhouse has a stake in this, which means that they'll franchise the shit out of it if it performs.
Which, by all accounts, it has. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, I could have definitely done with a more conclusive dead Michael. But, mm-hmm. you know, we can't have everything.
It's not like they're going to do this again in 20 years. You know, it's kind of, not to say that it's now or never, but, you know, now's the time. Put him out of his misery.
I think you're right there. Anyway, I think we'll go to our break now that we've wrapped up the synopsis. And mm-hmm. when we come back, we'll talk about what we liked, what we didn't, and then come up with some recommendations. So we'll be back in a moment.
Do you know that I pray every night that he would escape?
Who the hell did you do that for?
So I can kill him.
Hey guys, Jim here during the break to let you in on some ways you can help support our podcast. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on iTunes. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Got an idea for the next movie you'd like us to fix? Feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
You don't believe in the boogeyman?
He's here!
Michael!
You should.
And we're back. So, Matt, you want to tell us what you liked about this movie?
Yeah, I liked it. Overall, holistically, you know, looking at it as a complete package. I haven't been a Halloween completionist up till now. I've seen the first two. And really, the question was never, is Halloween 2018 going to top the first one? The question is it better than Halloween 2? In my mind, at least, that's the movie it's in direct competition with,
mm-hmm.
since it's positing itself as a direct sequel to the original. It's the first Halloween sequel that's ever been in that position since 1981, I think, is when Halloween 2 came out.
Yeah.
Which I guess means that H2O was in direct competition with Halloween 4, which is actually Halloween 3. This entire franchise is kind of a clusterfuck.
Yeah, just to give a quick rundown, Halloween 1 and 2 are directly connected because Halloween 2 literally picks up precisely when Halloween 1 ends.
They're very contiguous. It's like one like 3.5 hour long slasher movie
pretty much. And then Halloween 3 is completely unrelated to, it doesn't have Michael Myers.
Yeah.
It's just a completely different idea because the original intent behind the Halloween franchise was that it was
just
gonna be
an omnibus horror series.
Yeah,
everyone was about something different that just happened to transpire on Halloween night.
Yeah, and they just put out a new Halloween movie, you know, every Halloween or every other Halloween.
Which has limitless potential, and it's a shame that they put that off until the third installment, because by then it was too late.
Right, and so they tried that. That didn't really work out, and then there were three more sequels that got increasingly convoluted.
Yeah. So you've got a double feature, Halloween 1 and 2, and then one that we can basically discount, and then a kind of mediocre trilogy in the late 80s to like early 90s.
Yeah, and then there was kind of a soft reboot of sorts with H2O, where Jamie Lee Curtis comes back, and that's all right. And then there was a shitty movie called Halloween Resurrection with Busta Rhymes.
Yeah. I always forget that one.
That comes after that.
And then there were the Rob Zombie duology? Is that the name when there's two of them?
I think so. Okay. Either way,
doesn't matter.
It's Halloween and Halloween 2 from Rob Zombie, which were just a straight reboot. And now we have this one. So anyway, please continue.
So, can't say exactly where it ranks relative to all of those. I think I like it about as much as Halloween 2. I think I like Halloween 2 a little bit better, although Halloween 2 has some very silly stuff in it. It has a few notes that are just like pitch perfect. One nice touch during the opening credits is that whereas the credits in the original Halloween, it's got the classic orange font, you know, the kind of blocky text with that classic John Carpenter synthy score. Whereas in the original, it played out next to a lit jack-o'-lantern, kind of gleaming eerily in the darkness. Here, it's reversed footage of a decomposing jack-o'-lantern. So it's a jack-o'-lantern that's basically just a pile of orange mush that then it reconstitutes itself in slow motion, like the franchise is being brought back from the dead. You know, it's being resurrected before our very eyes, which is pretty funny. So the movie gets off to a good start, sort of puts its best foot forward that way. I think it does. The thing I'm most impressed by on a screenwriting level is that it does a very deft job of juggling, because it's become an intergenerational story at this point. It has to introduce us not just to Laurie's daughter, who we've never met, but Laurie's granddaughter, who we've definitely never met. You know, and they all kind of, the mother less so, Judy Greer less so than the other two, but all three of them kind of have a claim to the status of protagonist. At least Laurie and Allison do, for sure, at various points throughout the movie. But it's handled in a way where it's not, like, we complained about this in Slender Man, that it can't pick a protagonist, and there it just felt sloppy and slapdash. Here, the construction is a little bit tighter, and it gives all of them something to do, and they play off of each other, performed very well in the case of Jamie Lee Curtis. She's been getting a lot of plaudits for bringing the character forward 40 years in a way that's believable.
Yeah, I think in terms of setting up the characters, really the only ones that kind of bug me structurally are the podcasters.
Yeah, and even they're dispensed with relatively quickly. You know, they don't hog screen time.
And, I mean, I guess they're necessary if for no other reason than we need to get him the mask.
Yeah, and they're sort of exposition machines, too, when they're interviewing Laurie.
At the same time, I don't know, they do seem to be like a sort of underdeveloped third branch of the narrative at first.
Yeah, the movie does feel a little bit overstuffed until they're taken out of the picture. And, you know, I mean, Michael fucking obliterates people at a pretty steady clip in this movie. So anytime it seems like it's at risk of becoming overpopulated, he sorts that out pretty quickly. You know, like when the doctor does his heel turn and looks like he's going to become a secondary antagonist, that lasts all of 2 minutes, you know, and then Michael reasserts himself and says, no, just nips that in the bud, which is commendable. The doctor's heel turn, actually, I thought was, I don't know, did you anticipate that? I saw it coming, but not as far ahead as I would have liked. I only picked up on it like 10 or 15 minutes before it happened. I kind of sniffed it on the wind.
I don't think I really picked up on it too far in advance. I think in the last, you know, minute or so, when he was putting up a little too much resistance to
the idea, he wants Michael brought in alive, and he spends a lot of time waxing philosophical about like, oh, I want to know what it's like to kill someone. I'm really, you know, the movie that wasn't laid on quite that thick, but he does want to unpack. He wants to get into Michael's head, and it's apparent that he's spent the last 40 years kind of being driven mad, trying to contemplate Michael's pathology when really, you know, to take it from Dr. Loomis or Laurie Strode or Sheriff, what's his name? It starts with an H. Hawkins.
Deputy Hawkins.
Deputy Hawkins, my mistake. There's just nothing there. It's just a vacuum. So he's kind of goes mad in, you know, sort of a cosmic horror way from contemplating the unknowable,
yeah.
which I like.
I also enjoyed the music. I mean, obviously there's the
which was used tastefully and relatively sparingly.
But even beyond that, you know, there's more music, which I believe John Carpenter himself contributed to.
Mm-hmm.
For those of you who don't know, John Carpenter, he doesn't really direct movies anymore, but he still makes music, and it's still great.
So, it really ought to be more in vogue than ever with this 80s nostalgia renaissance that we're in the midst of.
Yeah, like if you watched It Follows, just that soundtrack right there.
It's the prime example.
It's just a shot right to the femoral artery of just some Carpenter vibes.
Very Carpenter-esque.
So, yeah, having him looped in on that was a masterstroke, I think. The soundtrack was generally quite good. And just in general, you know, David Gordon Green, again, he's made some shitty movies, but in general, he's a director who knows what he's doing. And, you know, there's not a lot of stupid composition decisions. Camera work is generally strong. There's one shot when Michael is about to engage in his second murder in Haddonfield, because the first one is when he kills the old lady and gets the knife. But the first knife kill is just of some woman who's talking on her phone in her house. And Michael spies on her through her window. And we basically just see the window. She's inside. And then on the right of the frame, Michael's reflection in the window. And that was good. I liked that a lot. Just, you know, things like that. Again, David Gordon Green knows what he's doing. He's a legitimate director.
Yeah, generally, I agree. I think his one handicap when it comes to this material, it kind of betrays his, like, indie dramedy background, is that it keeps cutting away. I found most of them pretty amusing, actually. It started for me with the guy taking his kid hunting. They're the ones who come upon the wrecked bus from the asylum. They bicker for like upwards of a minute before coming upon the scene of the accident about how the kid doesn't want to spend so much time hunting because he's gotten really invested in this dance class that he's enrolled in. And it's just a funny, very specific kind of exchange. Like, that's not stock horror movie victim dialogue. You know, it seems like something from, I don't know where it would feel more at home, but it felt out of place here in a way that I was, you know, basically at peace with. But then there are scenes like that just kind of keep cropping up at regular intervals, and I think it started to wear on me. Like, there was one between two cops talking about the lunches that they'd packed that day that just wasn't very funny at all, and that comes relatively late in the movie.
Yeah,
I felt like it was getting in the way of the movie having the momentum that I wanted it to have. It started to remind me, although it's nowhere near as inept as the kind of farcical cutaways in the original Last House on the Left to the bumbling cops whose car keeps breaking down. And that was just like Wes Craven being young and not understanding how tone works, thinking that he could inject some levity into Last House on the fucking Left, when really it just makes the whole thing even more garish and horrifying, which is why I wouldn't cut out those scenes given the chance, although they were a mistake. They're just a mistake I would prefer to keep.
Right.
It's not good that I'm being reminded of that in a movie released in 2018.
I think that pretty much covers, you know, what I was into about this movie. Now, what bugged you about it?
What bugs me about it? That's an excellent question.
I can
please
take this one then, I guess.
Oh yeah, let you field this one.
So, I think the biggest thing And you know, it's a difficult problem to fix, but you definitely feel the lack of Sam Loomis.
Oh yeah.
And in fact, there's one line which is kind of funny when Laurie and Dr. Sartain meet, where she just straight up says, "Oh, you're the new Loomis."
Yeah, that's as Scream as it gets the whole movie in terms of meta humor.
Right. And that was funny, but you know, after I laughed, the first thing I thought was, "Oh, well, not hard."
Yeah, we should be so lucky.
Yeah. And near the beginning, there's some archive audio of Donald Pleasance.
Is it actually? I kept hemming and hawing about whether or not it was an impersonator. If it's an impersonator, it's a very good one. I just wasn't sure if they'd commissioned new lines.
Yeah, I guess I'm not sure.
Again, I'm not enough of a Halloween aficionado to say for sure.
Anyway, my assumption was that it was Donald Pleasance. And like, that was cool on the one hand, but it also, for me, just helped to draw attention to the fact that Donald Pleasance is very deceased. He's not in this film, and
he's so good. Like functionally, you don't need him because Laurie has grown into that character, basically. So if he were here, he'd be redundant. It's just that Donald Pleasance is just so goddamn good that it feels like, you know, it's like when they do the SNL reunions and everyone but Eddie Murphy shows up.
Right.
You know, it's just like, well, that's too bad. It's just not perfect. You know, everyone, you know, the gang's all here except for one. And that's nobody's fault. It's just, you know, ephemerality of human existence.
Yeah. So that I did definitely feel the lack of Sam Loomis. And that's not to say that the movie just doesn't work without him, because obviously it does. But it's, I don't know.
And I like the way that they, you know, present a Sam Loomis analog and then subvert it and make him all curdled and twisted and deranged. That's because I feel like if, say, Donald Pleasance were still alive, still kicking, still alive and well,
I think he'd be about 100.
He'd be ancient.
Literally about 100.
But you know, if he were in the Dr. Sartain role and they tried to have him stab a cop in the
throat, I would have rioted.
Yeah, it would have been perverse. But you still, because those characters are. Because Sartain is contextualized as the new Loomis, I feel like you can still invoke that idea. And that's part of the reason it feels as subversive as it does, even though this is a new character who we theoretically shouldn't have any history or baggage, who we theoretically shouldn't be invested in. So I think it that works for the most part. Worked for me. Him putting on the mask was discomforting.
Yeah, and as I was saying,
we touched on that.
Not really in a way that I liked. I mean, you got a little bit, seemed to get a little bit more out of it than I did.
Well, I'm kind of clutching at straws in a true critic fashion. They're trying to think of
perversity,
to backwards engineer, like, you know, what were they thinking? That's the sort of the age old question.
Yeah, I thought it was just kind of goofy, but
yes, it was goofy. I would never contest that. It's by no means a perfect movie. The ending was underwhelming. I was pleased to see them incinerating him. I think that's the way to do it. I think it was the right choice in 1981. It's the right choice now. It's a bold move, particularly in, you know, the wake of all of these slasher franchises, Halloween included, that overstayed their welcome, kept spinning their wheels for way too long. It takes, you know, a degree of restraint and cojones to just say, no, we're going to draw a line this far, no further. We don't want your money, basically. And this movie looks like it's going to do that and basically does that, but there's still some plausible deniability in there.
We don't... Matt, you said earlier that we see Michael on fire.
That's almost not true.
That's almost not true. Like, we see... because he's, you know, trapped in the basement, and basically how it's done is Laurie's got this island, like a kitchen island, like a counter.
Yeah, not a tropical island.
Yeah, no,
that's the sequel there. It's, we're gonna do like a I Still Know What You Did Last Summer.
Oh, Christ.
They're gonna win a trivia contest.
Less said about that, the better. Anyway, this island like rotates 90 degrees and leads into a basement. And so the island has been ripped off, actually. Michael ripped it off during the final confrontation. But then when he's down there, they like turn a crank or flip a switch or something that causes these spikes to emerge from like either side of the opening.
It reminded me of something from like Resident Evil 4 or something. It was just very like Spanish Inquisition. They look all rusted and stabby. I don't know.
Very evil within.
Yeah.
So, yeah, he's behind bars, literally. Yes. And we see flames around him.
Mm-hmm.
The basement is very on fire, but we never entirely get the sense that Michael himself is on fire.
It's definitely not the classic full body burn effect that you imagine, either from Halloween 2 or from
Nightmare on Elm Street.
Or Thing from Another World. Any, you know, where you see an actual stunt performer wreathed in flame, flailing around, and then it cuts away and people rush in and douse the flames with fire extinguishers.
Right.
You know, where they've got the special flammable goo on them or whatever it is that keeps their skin safe.
Yeah.
It's not like that. It's like a CGI composition, and there's just something, yeah, a little bit unreal about it. And I don't think that it's bad. I don't think it's like shoddy CGI. I think it's done that way for the sake of ambiguity, which is what I resent.
Yes. No, it's definitely not that the effects are bad. The effects are doing exactly the job they were intended to do. It's just not a job that I want.
Which is to keep you guessing, yeah.
And I mean, it doesn't really make sense that Michael would survive.
No, it doesn't remotely make sense.
Well, I mean...
But that didn't stop the makers of Halloween 4.
Right. But like, even setting aside the house... It's not just the basement that's on fire. The entire house is on fire. The basement is very on fire. He is trapped in the basement. There's no way out. The house presumably collapses on top of him. There is no way that he should live, but that hasn't stopped them before.
No, and look, it's not unheard of for a great sequel to circumvent this problem. Bride of Frankenstein is great. Opens with the monster having miraculously survived a fire. In which his chances of survival were equally unlikely. So I'm reaching all the way back to 1935 to like think of a time when that was okay. But it's not impossible that if they make another Halloween, you know, if Jason Blum wants to keep printing himself money, it's not guaranteed to be bad. I don't know. Well, what do you call it for one thing? Halloween 2? That's ludicrous. It's the third one.
Yeah.
Kind of, and also kind of the 12th one.
Right. It's going to be difficult to number that sequel for sure. I think in the vein of fixing this movie's problems, and you know, you kind of shoot yourself in the foot if you're trying to go for a sequel, but fuck it, I don't think there should be a sequel necessarily. I would have shown a little more definitive Michael death.
Yeah, and Halloween 2 did it that way in the early 80s. So the precedent has been set, and your diehard fans are going to know how it was done before. So that makes this iteration just seem a little bit more evasive, I guess, is the word I would use.
And not in a way that I appreciate.
On a positive note, I really like that they brought back Nick Castle as Michael Myers. I think it's the first one he's ever come back for, actually. And I like it because this is something that they kind of can't get around because it takes him a long time to reclaim his mask just due to the machinations of the plot. So you get glimpses of his face here and there, and you see him in profile. You get a good look at his nose, his ears, you know, his graying hair. And I think that would have bothered me if it had been anyone except Nick Castle. There's something kind of... I don't know. This is going to make me sound a little bit crazy. There's something, just something a little bit eerie when you look at this dude who just looks like an ordinary guy pushing, 70 maybe?
Oh, 60.
Yeah, 60. That knowing that he was the guy wearing the mask in 1978 when they shot the original Halloween, if it had been any other Joe Schmo, I would have been in the audience, you know, been like, why are they showing us his face so much? It's taking away his mystique. But the fact that it's actually Nick Castle just totally circumvents that problem for me in a strange way. So that's a near miss for me on the problem front. It was almost like, you know, would have gone on my list of negatives, but they beat me to the solution, basically. They beat me at my own game.
Mm-hmm. I think the movie could have benefited a little bit in the early goings with cutting back on some of the family drama a bit.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it super worked. There's a scene where, you know, after the Honors Society ceremony for Allison, where she and her parents and her boyfriend go out to dinner, and apparently Lori's been invited, doesn't show up on time, but eventually turns up, and then is just kind of has a breakdown immediately.
Yeah.
And it's just like, what does this accomplish?
Yeah, her character does spend a little bit too much of the first act just kind of dangling by a thread psychologically. And this is before the bus crash, too. So it doesn't make quite as much sense that she's, you know, coming apart at the seams that way. I really like, it seems like in writing her character, they've really done justice to the trauma that that character's been through. They're much more realistic about it than, say, well, I don't know. I don't want to generalize, but it seems like they're taking the idea seriously that she's been living under this shadow for 40 years, you know, more so than in H2O, where she's basically very functional, but, you know, just has like periodic, like NOM flashbacks almost. Yeah. Here, it's a much more pervasive, it's kind of been woven into the fabric of her identity, which is a bold choice. I think it's the right choice, but it does make her character a little bit one note at times. So that's another criticism that I would advance, is that especially in that dinner scene, you're right, she just kind of falls to pieces
really out of nowhere. Like, mm-hmm. I don't, like, they do say something about her being agoraphobic earlier, and is it just like her being in a restaurant with people?
It's not framed that way.
No, it's not, but
there is one like kind of touching note in that scene, which is that her granddaughter has just been received some kind of prestige. What did you say it was?
Honor Society.
Yeah, Honor Society. And Jamie Lee Curtis goes, oh yeah, she's, you know, beaming with pride and says, I was in the Honor Society too, which harkens back to the old final girl trope of how it's the virginal one who takes their studies seriously. Right. It reminds you of what she was like when she was a teenager, that she was the one going, I don't know, guys, you know, I've got a test tomorrow. She, you know, she was the square relative to all her friends who got massacred. And that's the only riff on that idea in this movie, which I like. There's a little bit of it in Allison. You know, she's like, well, guys, it's a school night. But she says it kind of half-jokingly.
Mm-hmm.
That's during the school dance, right before she butts heads with her boyfriend and he drowns her phone in porridge. You know, that classic mixer food.
Every high school dance has to have porridge.
What was that shit? Like,
I still don't know.
Like, if he dunked it in a bowl of borscht, it wouldn't have been any stranger.
So,
or like slammed it inside a turducken.
That's another.
That was just there out of season.
Yeah. So that's a very small thing that could have been fixed. Just put it in a bowl of punch.
That's also weird that he never dies.
Yeah.
It's bizarre that we never see him again. The movie doesn't really have time for him, but it could have squeezed in another murder.
It could have squeezed in another murder, and if the movie had cut out, as we said, you know, some of the family drama stuff that doesn't really work quite as well.
Yeah, and some of the random cutaway banter between non-characters, like the two cops who are talking, like, almost like improv comedying about their lunches that they packed that day.
Their banh mi sandwiches.
Yeah, and their PB&J, which just did nothing for me.
No. I think that would have, yeah, given us time to see the boyfriend get murdered,
mm-hmm.
which would have been also cathartic because he's kind of a prick.
Yeah, it's just one less loose thread.
Yeah, and it's just, that would have been nice.
I have to say, just because I harped on it in the Hellfest review, this movie does a much better job at giving us teenagers who are likable enough that you feel something when they die, but not so relatable that you're, like, distraught.
Right.
You know, it's a very fine line. Talked about this at length in the Hellfest review. This movie is pretty on point for the most part. Definitely felt for Vicky,
Vicky.
When Vicky dies.
That was a bummer.
That was a bummer. But, you know, in other cases, there is usually some complicating factor that makes it at least a little bit cathartic when they're off. Like how the one guy gets killed right after he's made a clumsy pass at Allison and been like kind of a shithead about it.
Yeah.
And that's why it's weird that her boyfriend doesn't get stabbed. Not like I was crying for his blood, but it's, you know, it's a slasher formula at this point.
Yeah. So I think Cut out some family drama. Kill him off.
Or at least shuffle it around. If not cut it out. It's just a little bit.
It is also, you're right in that it's kind of front loaded a lot. It kind of thins out near the end, which also makes a certain amount of sense because, you know, momentum.
Yes.
But still, you probably could have shuffled it around. But yeah, just change that up some. Let's see the boyfriend get murdered. Let's see Michael actually die.
Yes, that's probably the number one for me.
Yeah. But I don't know. Overall, I think this is probably the best movie we've watched.
Oh yeah, definitely.
To date for this series.
Yeah, by a good margin for me at least.
So I guess that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I think so. I've a nagging feeling I'm forgetting something, but you know, it wouldn't be the first time.
Right. Well, this has been another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
And I am Matt Gerandese.
And we'll see you next time.
Just a quick note before we go. Upon further review, it seems that Matt's suspicions proved true. Loomis's recorded dialogue was done by sound-alike Colin Mahan, so score one for that guy. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Halloween official trailer, uploaded by Universal Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode, discussing the Suspiria remake, will be up on Sunday, November 11th. See you then.